We're very excited that on this wonderful International Women's Day, we're talking about functional OBGYN and all issues around things that have around the perinatal years, before, during, after. Dr. Anita Sadati is board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist who is in private practice. She graduated from Cornell University Medical College with honors and is assistant clinical professor at Hofstra Medical School, Northwell Health System. Dr. Sadati has been involved in several research projects in the Department of Biochemistry at Rockefeller University and in the Department of Surgery at New York Hospital, Cornell. She has been in private practice for 19 years and is currently completing her certification as functional medicine practitioner through the Institute of Functional Medicine. In addition to offering general obstetric and gynecological care, she has created a functional medicine program called Thrive Medical Wellness to address underlying mechanism of chronic disease, hormonal imbalance, and suboptimal health. She has a particular interest in recurring pregnancy loss and infertility, and works with women to optimize their chances for a natural pregnancy and to enhance pregnancy outcomes in the setting of artificial reproductive technology. Welcome, Dr. Sadati. So we'll be chatting about a few things, and then we'll definitely leave enough time for question and answer, as most of you have already emailed us that you're very excited about today, so we want to keep this very dynamic conversation. But what I wanted to start with is this specialty and this passion you have about unexplained infertility or miscarriage, and what is that functional approach to that population?
So my feeling is that patients that present with unexplained infertility or recurrent miscarriage are actually perfect patients to undergo a functional medicine workup. I found that most women are pretty much between 20 and 40. They're young. They're relatively healthy, you know, in terms of how much toxicity or how much accumulated toxicity they've experienced over time. And so they respond so well to a functional medicine workup. So 50% of women who are unable to get pregnant or 50% of women who have recurrent miscarriages, there's in a conventional setting, in a conventional workup, there's really no reason that they can be identified. So these patients are sort of left with either very invasive artificial reproductive technology, or they have to go into getting pregnant again with this unbelievable fear that they're going to miscarry again. So once, and not to belittle the 50% of patients who you do uncover a problem, but for the remainder, for the half, functional medicine seems to be very successful in terms of getting them to full-term pregnancy or to getting pregnant on their own.
There are also a lot of people that decide to get pregnant, but they've been on birth control for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And there's hormone contraception, there's certain effects that come with that birth control for years and years. How do we care for that population? And because it's not really thought of as anything problematic, and right, it's given out with such ease. And so, you know, do you find it, well, one, what are the effects that you find that could be detrimental? But then also, is it difficult to really fully educate when they've been told that they are safe and do their thing, and then you can just come off them?
I think the biggest challenge with trying to give someone actual informed consent about oral contraception is that nobody really wants to hear about it. You know, it is so convenient. It's part of the fabric of, you know, sort of being an independent woman and, you know, being able to control your fertility. It's extremely convenient. You know, there are a lot of social benefits and, you know, physical benefits in terms of knowing when to predict your period is coming, lessening the cramping, lessening the period, manipulating when you're going to get your period, helping with acne. I mean, there are a million things that people, you know, run and jump to go on the birth control pill. So even when you try to educate women about what the downside could be, because remember, you're going to be on this, it's a medication, it's high-dose hormone, and you're on it not for months, but years, decades, potentially. And then when you stop, you're surprised that your body's not you know, functioning appropriately, or that you're not able to get your cycles back, or that you still don't have libido, or you know all these side effects that end up accumulating from being on the birth control pill for so long. So what I find is that even though I am much more educated right now about what the side effects of birth control can be, especially after long-term use, it's not a receptive population to want to hear about it. They don't want to hear about, you know, the fact that nutrient deficiencies and nutrient depletions are going to be significant when you're on the birth control pill for so long. They don't want to know that they, you know, may be altering the beneficial bacteria balance in their gut and how that can be contributing to some of their gut issues and imbalances. They don't want to hear about the fact that maybe their fertility is not going to return so promptly once they stop the pill. It's an uphill battle to really have patients appreciate what that means when they're not in the space of really thinking about it. Even though it's very difficult for me to prescribe birth control pills and with, you know, feeling like I'm doing something that's really overall could be potentially harmful for somewhere between 50 to 20% of patients. I mean, I think that the majority of patients are fine. They're able to handle the birth control pill, but then you have upwards of 20% of patients who are not going to do so well, and they don't understand that what they're feeling, you know, or these polypharmacy that's now accumulating with them for the IBS now, or for the anxiety, or for the depression, that could be related to their birth control pill.
I mean, we know that everything affects the microbiome, and now we have these IUDs that people are, you know, even after pregnancy, they're now on an IUD. And what are the effects on the female body for even post-pregnancy?
Post-pregnancy?
Just with the, you know, just generally speaking, what are the effects of the IUDs on the microbiome, and what exactly, you know, are we dealing with? We just discussed how difficult it is to kind of give all this information, but what are we seeing? Are we seeing, like you just mentioned a few things, but is there something that you see a pattern?
Up until very recently, the two major options for IUDs were either high-dose progestin-coated IUD, the Mirena, and the Paragard, which is copper-coated, and that's your basically your only your non-hormonal long-term option. So with the copper IUD, you would think that there would be much more impact on the vaginal ecosystem, but in the literature, there really doesn't seem to be any association between the copper IUD and imbalances in the vaginal bacterial balance. Although there is the potential for colonization with actinomyces, which is definitely a bacteria that can lead to more problems and potentially pelvic inflammatory disease and infertility, it's very rare, especially with the current Paragard model. The Mirena is a different story, and about 10 years ago is when I really started noticing in my patients that they were developing pretty severe mood disorders, anxiety, weight gain, and because these symptoms developed sort of very distant from the time of insertion, it was very difficult for them to make that association. And certainly physicians were also reluctant to equate these symptoms with the Mirena when patients were complaining about these problems a year or two later. But clearly this started happening with so many patients. There started to pop up chat rooms and groups with Mirena and all these problems that, by the way, didn't necessarily resolve even after the Mirena was removed. I had a few patients that really required a pretty extensive functional workup after removing the IUD just to get them back to baseline. So, and again, I think that there are, as we all know, just based on whatever your genetic predispositions are going to be and what your personal SNPs are, that's going to impact whether any kind of hormonal contraception is going to be problematic for you, especially if you're using it long term. Now it's very interesting because they've developed two lower dose progestin containing IUDs, the Kylena, which is about a fifth of the dose of Mirena and is a 5-year option, and the Skyla, which is a 3-year IUD, which was marketed to younger women because it's thinner, it's longer lasting, there's less hormonal side effects. So I've just started getting experience with patients receiving the Kylena IUD. I'm certainly recommending that over the Mirena, if at all possible. And it's going to be time to really see clinically, according to the pharmaceutical reps, you know, it doesn't affect mood, it doesn't affect, you know, I can't, whatever. But we'll see what happens in time. But at least there's an option for women who can't tolerate the Paragard. I mean, the Paragard is really difficult with so much bleeding. It's really crampy. It prolongs your period to 7 or 8 days. It's really not fun for most patients. So at least there's something a little bit more lower dose that's more local. So we'll see if that is helpful. But neither the Mirena or the Paragard necessarily impact the vaginal microbiome.
Interesting. So let's say you do now have a pregnant patient. We're going to get into a little bit of...
question about the IUD?
Yeah, yeah.
Question. Have you tested the women for mineral and heavy metals? Because copper relatively can cause a zinc deficiency, and that could explain the, you know, a lot of the infertility problems. So it would be interesting to at least test for the possibility of...
That is interesting. I've actually only recently started testing patients for copper and zinc imbalance. Not specifically someone with the Paragard, but certainly I also think that that imbalance is also going to be predicted more with their personal genetic mutation makeup.
Sure.
You know, so, but yeah, I think I just started testing that for this year. And, you know, so far I haven't tested a Paragard patient, but that's a fantastic idea.
So just wanted to touch on the standard testing around pregnancy and some of the controversy around ultrasounds, and are they needed, and how many, and when do you find that you really do, you know, which one would you do if you do, and do you find that they're a problem, or are they totally fine and we should all be going on, well, some, you know, we have many people who are high risk and getting pregnant, you know, getting their ultrasounds every month. I mean, you know, so what's your take on ultrasounds and just general standard of testing around pregnancy and how it is in the current Western model?
So interestingly, even back when I was in medical school, there was actually a very large study that came out comparing populations of pregnant women who were sort of unindicated screening with ultrasound during pregnancy versus women who had indicated screening. And according to that very large nation-based study, there was no difference in outcome. And that was looking at sort of the introduction of introducing universal, comprehensive, mid-trimester, comprehensive ultrasound screening. That was basically two ultrasounds performed in pregnancy. Now currently, minimally, a patient is getting three ultrasounds, minimally, and generally way more than that in a standard low-risk pregnancy. And generally speaking, there's really, for the most part, no indication for most of that ultrasound. In my opinion, I think that, well, let's back up. As far as, you know, just sort of ultrasound technology, the acoustic output has increased so significantly from what those original studies that said that there was no fetal harm with medically indicated ultrasound. The acoustic output from those machines compared to the current technology was 5 to 7 times less. And I don't think that there have been really any studies since then that have confirmed that what's being used currently still has the same safety data as was recorded initially. Number two is that that's also not taking into account the amount of time the patients spend getting ultrasound and, of course, the competency of the technologist. So it's really apples and oranges as far as safety is concerned. So that's sort of number one. But number two is that because patients have this, and doctors, I mean, really, doctors feel that the technology is extremely safe, it has become an integral part of reassuring patients about the health of their pregnancy, even though there are probably only a handful of pregnancy conditions where ultrasound may impact their outcome. So for the majority of cases, it's just not, the data is not there to say that it's helpful. Now, I think that even from my own experience, even in my own office, we have a very busy obstetrical practice, and we have our own radiologist who specializes in obstetrical ultrasound in the office. There is a lot of consumer demand for ultrasound. Mm-hmm. Patients self-label themselves high risk so that they can get more ultrasound. They will pay out of pocket if their insurance declines to get more ultrasound. And the doctor's making money out of it. So, you know, there's sort of no interest in, you know, uncovering what's really going on behind here. I was part of that machine. You know, it's safe. The patient likes it. It makes them feel comfortable. Of course, get the ultrasound. You know, and now I'm just actively convincing patients to stop getting these myriad ultrasounds for no reason. What I feel that would be ideal from a research perspective would be to have an ultrasound mid-trimester for an anatomy sonogram. I think patients get to have a, you know, a vote as to whether or not the baby is anomalous. I mean, you get to know that in pregnancy, if that's going to impact whether or not you're going to continue in a pregnancy or not. Whether or not they necessarily need an early ultrasound, the data is pretty clear that if you're doing it just for the sake of dating and somebody who has pretty confirmed dates, they have regular menses, they don't have any bleeding, their size dates clinically are okay, then they don't need an ultrasound in the beginning. If they're going to receive a procedure, if it's someone who wants to have chorionic villus sampling, or if someone does have bleeding, or they have a history of an ectopic or a PID, and you're worried about first, you know, what's happening the first trimester, there's data to support using it. But beyond that, you know, and I now have a few patients that are not getting ultrasound screening. It's, I mean, my partners don't even know what to do with us. Like, really, it's just like, why is she here? You know, she's not going to get ultrasound. I'm like, well, that's, I'll tell him or, you know, so. But I think that a mid-trimester sonogram is something a patient should definitely have access to make a decision. If they have a severely abnormal fetus, they get to decide what they want to do. But in the original studies, did that impact outcome? No, it didn't. Patients oftentimes didn't, you know, elected to continue with the pregnancy regardless of what was going on. Or if they did elect to intervene, it wasn't enough to make a difference as far as outcomes. I personally feel like it's just something that everybody should have an option to do. But that's probably the only screening in a low-risk population that makes sense. After that, with high-risk pregnancy, well, high-risk pregnancy is anything. High-risk is, if you're on Long Island, you're high-risk. You know, which probably is kind of true. For gestational diabetes, it's not helpful. For chronic hypertension, it's not helpful unless there's IUGR, unless there's growth restriction. Then there's data to support doing serial ultrasounds for growth and fetal well-being. We start doing post-term antepartum surveillance at 40 weeks. The literature recommends at least waiting until 41. And so we end up diagnosing all these patients with low amniotic fluid intervening with induction, even though there haven't been studies to show that inducing for oligohydramnios at term with an otherwise normal behaving baby improves outcome, other than potentially increasing C-section rate. It's very difficult to practice in a conventional setting with this information, because you just feel like everything that you're doing is not necessarily in the patient's best interest.
I think, you know, there are many practitioners in the room that are transitioning from a traditional medical model into the functional medicine world, and I just wanted you to touch on that transition for yourself and what you've been experiencing as you're going through that, and to tell us a little bit more about your Thrive program, which falls under, you know, your functional approach.
Yeah. Well, I guess I started doing functional medicine about 3 years ago in my practice, and trying to do it under, I mean, I'm an insurance-based practice, trying to do it with insurance, which meant, you know, scheduling these visits at the end of my session or coming in early so I had enough time to, you know, discuss everything with the patients. And patients were very interested in pursuing functional medicine testing or pursuing a more integrative approach as long as it was under insurance. You know, I mean, that was a no-brainer, you know. But once I decided to create the actual functional medicine program that was going to be separate from insurance and only available to patients who wanted to pay out of pocket, and that's why I called it a wellness program, it wasn't so easy to necessarily make that conversion. Which was hard for me because I felt that their problems really needed to be, they deserved to be addressed with a functional medicine approach. and, you know, not handing them. I mean, I joke, but my first 10 years of practice was Prozac and a birth control pill. That was what I had, you know, that was, if that didn't work, I was out of answers. You know, now I feel like everybody should have a functional medicine approach, you know, to any hormonal problem. So it's taken a little bit of time. The program itself is basically an initial intake, which I do under insurance. You know, just what are the problems that you're experiencing and discussing how we can address them outside of a pharmaceutical model, because that's what the patient's interested in. So after that initial intake, I have them complete a pretty extensive questionnaire with diet and lifestyle history, kind of create, I use the timeline. You guys familiar with the IFM timeline and matrix and stuff, so I kind of use that loosely. And I will often order a comprehensive blood panel under their insurance, and then they should pay for one functional test. And depending on where the majority of their problems are, where I think we're going to get the most bang for their buck, I'll either start with an adrenal female hormone panel or like a comprehensive digestive stool analysis. So once I have that, and I have all their information, I put together a personalized program with their nutrition, their exercise, their support, you know, whatever. And then we address the abnormalities that we find on the lab work and the testing. And so much of that information, when we sit down together and I go over it with them and they see, they understand how the abnormalities on the testing is consistent with what they're experiencing personally, I find the lab testing makes patients more compliant. You know, after a while, you don't need the tests, you know what's going to come out, you can just treat them, you know, the way you think they should be treated. But in my experience, the testing is so powerful in making the patient compliant and sort of having them buy into the program, that there is an abnormality, you know, there is an imbalance, there is a toxicity, there is a nutrient deficiency, whatever it is, I sort of have them understand it within the context of their history. And they're so satisfied. It's just getting them to that point has been difficult. So out of, let's say, 10 patients who express interest in the program, because I have the pamphlets, you know, in the waiting room and in my exam rooms, probably one will actually move forward. And that's within an insurance model. So as I start transitioning into gynecology only, is that the end of the talk?
No. That's somebody's cell phone.
As I start into integrative medicine, I find that I'm getting referrals not within my practice now who have heard about what's going on. And so it's going to be easier now. But I find that converting the patient from an existing insurance patient who's not necessarily in that integrative space is a lot harder than I thought it was going to be.
I think it's interesting because millennials are very much like, in the know, want to go natural, want to, you know, investigate things that are going on with them, and they're very keen towards a more natural approach. And I think that, you know, James will comment on, you know, how the functional medicine community is growing, and I think that the patient population and the idea of wellness and all of the different tools and kind of having a more open mind to alternative therapies even has grown. And I think that I know that I'm telling all my friends and all my sister's friends who are getting ready to get pregnant, like, don't do it the way I did it. Somehow it worked for me 3 times, but, you know, really, if I knew I knew then what I know now, I would have done it completely differently, and it probably would have also maybe even affected my next change of life much better. And so, you know, this is a community that is very dear to a lot of us here at Kima. We have a whole prenatal postpartum program, and it's a community that I'm very is very dear to my heart, because I feel that the postpartum population is really just like, oh, your baby, kick out the door, bye. And and it's like, well, wait a minute, are we supporting? And we talked a lot about women leadership, and we're great communicators, and we are taking care of a lot of people, and we're not taking care of. And so I think that it's definitely the knowledge needs, the information needs to get out there, and people like you need to be helping to spread that word. And I do think, though, that we are an age where, you know, it is being we're finally getting people to listen, and they're questioning, should I do this, and things like that. So I think it's a very exciting time. I just wanted to open up the floor to anyone that may have some questions, comments, have a little discussion going. Yep.
What your next step would be for Thrive, what you would love to do like over the next 10 years, what you would like to turn into, how you would like to take care of, if it's like a membership model, if it's like anything that starts to become like your main focus.
Did everybody hear the question? Yes? Okay, good. Great question.
I'm currently transitioning into a gynecology-only practice, more integrated medicine, hopefully by this summer. So I'm enjoying my last deliveries, you know, for the last few months. But I think that the current model is that I'm using with the Thrive program is time-based, and you know, the amount of time that you spend, that's how much, you know, the patient's charged. So I think the membership model definitely makes more sense if you have enough patients to do sort of group visits and group classes. I think until that happens, though, it's financially a little bit of a tipping point, you know, where the number of visits, it's hard, you know, it's hard to predict how many visits someone's going to need and how much hand-holding they're going to need by coaching and things like that. So I feel like as I get more experience within the current model, I'll be able to figure out a little bit more how the membership model makes more sense. I definitely have several programs in mind, you know, things like mastering your metabolism or mastering your hormones, you know, that kind of stuff, where it's a much more targeted approach with, you know, very limited testing, but it's a little bit more cookie cutter, but it still is going to bring people to a different level of health if they're able to follow the step-by-step guide. So I like the idea. I think patients like a package like that. They seem to be pretty excited about any tools, any blood testing or genetic marker combo packages that give them a little bit more insight into their individual needs, either for hormone balance or for weight management or whatever. So those are programs that I'm playing around with right now, which will be more, I guess, financially available to more people. That's sort of my next iteration of the program.
You spoke about, first thank you for coming and sharing your experiences with us. And you spoke about ultrasound, but did speak specifically about concerns. You mentioned acoustical output.
Yeah.
So is that something that affects hearing or development?
Meaning that I was referring to the intensity of the sound waves for ultrasound. So the concerns are that it can affect neural tissue, neuronal migration. It can affect organogenesis. There are definitely rodent models that show that there are concerns with even 30 minutes of ultrasound exposure early on in embryonic development. So it's more that the intensity of the ultrasound may be impacting development. There's also concern about things like autism, you know, the amount of exposure of ultrasound. I mean, again, you have, unfortunately, how do you tease out the chicken and the egg? Generally, the women that have higher risk pregnancies are the ones that are getting more ultrasound, and therefore they're the ones that are going to have higher risks of autism or neurodevelopmental delays and things like that. So twin pregnancies, for example, that's an indication for more frequent growth surveillance and antepartum surveillance, because you have two babies vying for the placental nutrients and blood flow, and so you're often going to see discordancy in growth and potentially delayed plateauing of growth. So those patients get a lot of ultrasounds, but twins also deliver earlier. They're at higher risk for gestational diabetes and chronic hypertension and preeclampsia. So it's hard to say, were the 10 ultrasounds they got in pregnancy the problem, or was it because they had twins and they developed preeclampsia, or they had gestational diabetes, or they delivered 4 weeks early? So it's very difficult. I mean, these studies are not easy to do, and the numbers are so huge that need to be done, and nobody's really that willing to do it. You know, it's very expensive, and I don't think, you know, just like everything else, who wants to really study that? You know. Yes, Dr. Hoffman.
Thanks for coming and sharing. The theme that I'm seeing a lot of women who come to see me who are premenopausal and perimenopausal mm-hmm. is estrogen dominance. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're seeing, and do you have an approach that you where you address that?
I mean, that's almost practically anybody over 35, you know, is estrogen dominant. My initial approach to estrogen dominant to dominance, if somebody wants to do a functional approach, is really, again, sort of that comprehensive blood panel with adrenal hormone testing. And at least if not, you know, if they don't want to do a month-long hormone panel, then at least a day 19 to 21 progesterone level. So when I start there, I would say of the patients that I've tested, 99%, you know, have some adrenal imbalance. So that's kind of my entry into how I'm going to address the estrogen dominance. You know, the question when I explain to patients what estrogen dominance is, I tell them, well, you know, either you have a situation where you're creating too much estrogen, which can be related to, of course, environmental exposures and endocrine disruptors or gut imbalance and recycling of hormones back into the system or unfiltered, well, I mean, goes for on forever. Or they have a situation where their estrogen may be normal or even lower than normal, but their progesterone is completely tanked, which even though there's a little bit of question about whether or not the whole pregnenolone steal mechanism is really valid here to explain progesterone deficiency, it is an unbelievably effective tool in terms of getting patients to understand how stress hormone imbalance is impacting the estrogen and progesterone ratio imbalance. I'm sorry.
Do you add glyphosate into the mix in your discussion? Because the glyphosate has estrogenic properties and disruptions.
Yeah, when we start talking about how to reduce the environmental exposure for endocrine disruptors, then yeah, that of course we're talking about pesticides and glyphosate exposure. But I find that the adrenal hormone entry seems to be, and the stress hormone avenue seems to be pretty effective for balancing those symptoms. So, of course, when you're talking about that, that's revamping the diet, revamping sleep, and then doing some sort of products that support liver, you know, support the liver to help, you know, cycle your estrogen through, probiotics, cleaning up the gut, the whole thing. But I find that just addressing the adrenal with the diet and stress components makes a huge difference. Now, in those patients where that doesn't work, then you have to dig further as to why the estrogen dominance is happening. And that usually brings you to the gut and fixing that and looking for pathogens or food allergies or dysbiosis, whatever it is. When you start fixing the gut, the estrogen, the hormone balance is going to get better as well. But it kind of depends on how old they are. I think that if they're in their late 30s and they're having estrogen dominant symptoms, then again, that lack of accumulated toxicity, they're much more likely to respond to an adrenal diet program versus patients that are now in their late 40s, early 50s, way more toxicity. It's not just going to be stress hormone imbalance. Now you have to dig deeper in terms of more nutrient deficiencies or heavy metal toxicity or gut disturbance or whatever. So I find that the age group kind of dictates what the testing should be. Is that what you're finding?
That's a very comprehensive overview.
I had heard about for the people who have that estrogen reuptake and via gut issues, mm-hmm. that calcium deglucurate
yeah.
Has been very helpful.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you have seen actual positive effects of, you know, supplementation and things like that.
Yeah, I use calcium deglucurate as part of an estrogen dominance supplement protocol mm-hmm. in conjunction with just general like DIM support or like a liver support supplement of your choice. We can say names of things, right?
Yeah.
I happen to like Pure Encapsulations DIM Detox, you know, as a great estrogen dominance. I like Thorin Research Bio-PMT for a luteal phase support. It has a lot of B-complex, magnesium, calcium, Vitex, wild yams. It just helps to improve your natural progesterone balance, mm-hmm. adrenal support, you know, for stress hormone regulation. But, yeah, that's calcium deglucurate is definitely a foundational product for estrogen dominance.
Do you require your patients to come in with a genetic profile, and how do you incorporate that?
The question is genetic
just,
testing.
For example, like a 23andMe or something
like
that.
Right.
No, not at all.
Just your testing.
You know, just for doing a functional medicine evaluation, or
right.
No,
not.
I personally got along without it. I think that there are so many question marks regarding how these different SNPs interact. They have opposing actions and activities and enzymatic, you know, effects. And I certainly don't think that that necessarily impacts the supplement recommendations. I think in general people are a little too supplement happy already, and that when you have this list of mutations and you start throwing 20 different supplements at somebody, it's more dangerous. And you know, more and more there, you know, just with the whole MTHFR mutation issue, patients going on mega doses of B vitamins, whether they're methylated or not. You know, there's the whole hypermethylation problem that's happening right now, and people are being a little too cavalier with how much vitamin supplementation they're administering. So although I have been doing, you know, MTHFR testing forever, you know, as part of recurrent miscarriage workup for 20 years, you know, that's always been the case. And I think it's helpful to know about that as far as educating the patient and, you know, what they should be on the lookout for, what they may be more inclined to develop from a disease perspective or nutrient deficiency or, you know, toxicity perspective. I haven't had to use that, you know, but that's just my population. Like, I feel like I have patients between their mid-20s to 50s. That's kind of my wheelhouse for patients. And I don't think, you know, there's so much to clean up. I don't think that I need to get to the genetics yet. But now, there are now so many programs that are available that help patients really personalize what their supplement should be with the interaction of 6 or 7 very clinically relevant, clinically tested mutations. I love that. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense to know where to tune up and down your vitamin supplementation based on how these well-studied in clinical, you know, settings, well-studied SNPs interact with each other. I think that's fantastic. I'm starting to do that testing, but whether or not that's helpful, we'll find out. Yeah.
Thank you.
So Ellen? The question was, it sounds to me that your program is very comprehensive and you give a lot of nutrition and also lifestyle practices recommendations. So I was just curious to know if you have a nutritionist in your team or if something that you would be considering in the future. We tried growing to have nutritionists to help coaches. I find that doctors, they don't have as much time to actually give that recommendation.
Yeah.
So if you have a support or a team for that.
I have several health coaches that I use. They're not nutritionists necessarily, but the training that they have and the understanding they have about the type of nutrition that I want patients to work on and optimize, their knowledge is much more in line with, of the ones that I know, are much more in line with what my recommendations would be. So I do have practitioners, not within my practice, but that I refer to. And in fact, I do, as part of the program, I give patients a free 20 or 30 minute wellness health coaching session so that they at least have an introduction to what that can be, and then they can decide if they want to then continue with that wellness coach. But the ones that I work with have such in-depth knowledge of functional medicine and nutrition. Yeah, but hopefully, yeah, when I'm in my own space, yeah, then that's going to be part of it.
Has that process been effective?
Which one?
With the health coaches, working with the health coaches.
Oh, yeah. Way. The patients love it.
They love it.
You know, it's...
And they've been making the changes that...
Yeah. Well, the way I explain it to them is that this is what I want you to do, and they're going to tell you how you can actually make this realistic for yourself. So they're going to explain, when you work from 6 in the morning until 8 at night, how are we going to get in a low FODMAP paleo diet or whatever, you know, whatever it is, or low histamine, you know, whatever it is. They're the ones that are going to help make it a reality for you. You know, whether that's doing a supermarket shopping tour, or they know the tricks of, you know, what kinds of, you know, bars, like just a quick fix. But they help to make it possible for them, especially younger patients, teenagers that I've had, who, you know, it's a bagel for breakfast, it's a bagel or pizza for lunch, and it's pasta for dinner. And they can't even imagine eating a green item. So, you know, so they, sadly, that's who these patients are, you know. And so they're the ones that are going to make it more realistic. And so they love it. And it's so, I've found it very successful. Patients love the health coaches that they've interacted with, if they'll make the call. Mm-hmm. You know, they just have to call. Yeah.
Do they see them live or both, Skype?
Both, yeah. So I have someone locally, out east on the, for me, out east on the island, and then someone more locally where we live. And then I have some from Manhattan, and they can do it either on the phone or Skype or in person. You know, there's options for whatever they prefer, especially if I have kids that are going back to college. Mm-hmm. So they're, well, you know, they'll do phone consultations.
Justine?
So I treat women's health, and I'm seeing more and more women who have the diagnosis of PCOS.
Yeah.
And I wonder your thoughts on the functional medicine approach to it, because I've found that most of the time it's just managed with birth control,
yeah,
or metformin, or whatever it may be, and I wonder if there are other more holistic
options. Well, that's another thing. In line with, you know, recurrent miscarriage and infertility, PCOS is ripe for functional medicine. It's harder, though. You know, it really, it's a very difficult hormonal imbalance to fix. It takes a long time. Patients have to be really patient. Patients have to be patient. 'Cause it's not so easy, you know, as opposed to other things that when women have certain hormonal things, it just flips so quickly sometimes. PCOS is not one of them. The weight loss is slow. The impact on hair growth is slow. The acne is slow. You know, the resumption of menses is slow. It's really a drawn out process. So it's definitely the way to go. You know, that cardiometabolic imbalance, it's certainly, you know, diet and exercise and sleep and adrenals, but it's just harder to move the needle on those patients. So what I do, you know, with PCOS is, you know, first of all, to definitely turn around the diet to make it a little, you know, to improve their sugar and insulin balance. So I typically revert to, you know, just a standard, you know, paleo approach to begin with. Though, for women who are specifically wanting to get pregnant, you have to be really careful about counseling them not to go too low carb, which is unfortunately a mistake, this inadvertent low-carb situation that happens, because that works against you from an adrenal perspective. So first to get that in gear and make sure that they are in some sort of an exercise program consistent with whatever their adrenal testing is. If they're, you know, it's very important, I think, with these patients to get some symptomatic relief. So if they're having issues with unwanted hair growth or hair loss or PMS or like a heavy periods, you know, even though they're far apart, to do some things to help balance that. So, that, you know, then again, that's where supplements will come in. So a lot of Vitex, a lot of N-acetylcysteine. I like to use sugar support supplementation, anything with gymnema and alpha lipoic acid and cinnamon and chromium, you know, that kind of stuff. For patients that, let's say, are a little further down the road, they've lost some weight, their ovulation has resumed, and let's say fertility has been an issue. There are a lot of studies that show patients that, let's say, they do need to go on some sort of ovulation induction agent like Clomid or Femara, then I like to add a few supplements that in studies has been shown to enhance pregnancy rates. So, for example, melatonin at a 3 milligram dose at night helps to improve egg quality and ovulation with Clomid and pregnancy rates. I like to use, not in PCOS patients, but in other patients with egg quality issues, DHEA, 25 milligrams 3 times a day, up to 4 months. That's in women under 38, that tends to be pretty helpful. For the PCOS patient, there's also N-acetylcysteine is also really great at about 1,200 milligrams a day. There are studies that show that that improves ovulation and pregnancy rates. So the symptom and the desire to get pregnant more quickly, you know, that's what these patients want. I tend to be a little more supplement heavy in patients that have fertility because they just feel like the clock is ticking and every month they're not pregnant is just a disaster. So those are some things that are validated in studies that are, you know, that I throw in the mix.
So I just wanted to thank Dr. Sabati.
Hi, this is Dr. Anita Sadati. Thanks for listening. If you're interested in learning more about my integrative gynecology and functional medicine practice, please visit my website, drsadati.com. That's drsadati.com. Or you can call my office at 516-801-1313. That's 516 801-1313.